The Church's Music from the 20th Century. The 17th Century. The 11th Century. The 8th Century. The 4th Century. The best of the Church's music from the past 2,000 years. LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Welcome back to Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're analyzing the Supreme Court's decision today to legalize homosexual marriage. A few more of our guests will be brought alongside here for that conversation, including Sharif Girgis, who will join us here in just a moment, co-author of the book, What is Marriage? Man and Woman in Defense. Then Pastor Matt Harrison, president of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, will weigh in as well. We'll get his thoughts on this in terms of not only the future of the church here, because that is of primary concern, obviously, for him, but also, generally speaking, for religious freedom as well. Then we're going to play Issues Etc. soundbite of the week. We've got four soundbites that we brought forward from this week's Issues Etc. audio. We're going to play them for you, and then your vote will decide which one will be Issues Etc. soundbite of the week. Sharif Girgis is a regular guest. He's a PhD candidate in philosophy at Princeton University and a JD candidate at Yale Law School, co-author of the book, What is Marriage? Man and Woman, a Defense. Sharif, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, Tom.
Other than the obvious decision here that, or the threshold legally that has been crossed with any Supreme Court decision, what threshold has been crossed in the thinking, the ideology, the mindset of the American people? Because law does teach, and a lot of people consider legal to be both rational and right. What other threshold has been crossed with the Supreme Court's decision?
Sure. Well, I think the main one, the most obvious one, is that the highest court in our land now says that it's effectively bigotry to think that kids need their own mom and dad. So the prestige and the institutional power of that court is going to shape culture, at least in the near future, on that idea.
Was the decision, we've talked about whether it was constitutional, but was it a rational decision taken by the court's majority?
Not at all. I think the four separate dissents, and it's really striking that each of the dissenters wrote their own opinion showing why the majority goes wrong, really do show that it's not even that it's bad reasoning. It's almost based on no reasoning at all. It doesn't take any time. It doesn't bother at all to lay out the legal rationale behind it. It just sort of effectively says, we think this is a really good idea and a really important policy, and we think that people are harmed by not having it. So as a piece of legal reasoning, it's just about as bad as it gets.
Giving them the benefit of the doubt, the court's majority on this decision. I mean, we're not talking about, generally speaking, we're not talking about people who are, at least from my perception, given to thinking in reactionary ways. They tend to have gotten to the positions they have on the high court by being careful in their decision-making, being careful in their legal reasoning. They're intelligent people. How did five Supreme Court justices succumb to this kind of decision based upon very little real argument?
Well, you're absolutely right that they're all extremely intelligent and competent people, and across a wide range of issues, they can be pretty much relied on to do a serious job. They have kind of predictable disagreements, but they're all doing recognizably legal analysis. But there are two other things at stake. One is that I think on some issues, the temptation to legislate is just too great. Here they have every voice, every elite voice in the culture telling them that they can make or break history, that this is going to put them down for the ages, that this is their moment of, you know, anti-segregation and similar landmark cases. But the second thing that it is out in the open. I mean, it's if you asked some of at least four of the justices, they'd openly admit to this, is that they don't think every decision just comes down to the law and the logic and text and history of the Constitution. They think some of them, some decisions are such big deals, so to speak, that they can bring in their own judgments about what justice requires. That's on the face of the opinion. That's something they've said in interviews. And that's a really pernicious idea, whatever you think about same-sex marriage. It's one that really undermines the rule of law and the separation of powers across the board.
Does that either say something about or does it indicate something about the future of the current state of American jurisprudence?
Yeah, I mean, I just think it heightens the stakes. It tells future people who want to lead a movement of any kind at all, tells them, look, if you fail for long enough in the court of public opinion, in the state houses all across the country, here's another solution. Pick your favorite judges, create what looks like a tide of judicial decisions in your favor, and then wait for it to go up to the Supreme Court and see what they do there. I mean, we now have like a new way of making law. You know, we all learn in seventh grade civics, how does a bill become a law? Like, here's one way through the House and the Senate and the President. Here's another way. Like, get the right courts to do it for you. That's, I think, a really bad idea. Again, whatever you think about the substance.
If you were going to describe the philosophical shift that has come both before, obviously during, and then I think will follow after the Supreme Court decision. I mean, these things these decisions are not taken or made or in a vacuum, and they obviously have long-reaching consequences. How would you describe that philosophical shift in American thinking?
Well, I think there's one on the court level and judicial level, and then there's one about the cultural and the substantive issue of marriage. And both of them fed into this. So on the level of the courts, I think we really do just think that increasingly, two things, I guess. One is that the court, the justices are guardians of equality in general, not just the forms of it that are enshrined in the Constitution, not just guaranteeing the forms of it that we protect by laws that we pass, but that in some free-floating sense, they're empowered to sit down and figure out what's true and just, and that somehow they're in a better position to do that than our elected representatives. That's one idea. And I think on the substance of marriage, if you look at the opinion, it's not very big on legal reasoning, but it is very clear what vision of marriage it's assuming in the background. And it's assuming a vision of marriage that says it doesn't have any inherent connection to kids or family life. It doesn't have any inherent connection to this kind of mundane public purpose of giving kids their own mom and dad. It's really primarily about companionship. Now, obviously, I'm not against companionship. Everybody needs it, and every human life requires it to flourish. But that's not what marriage is. It's not just about companionship. If it were that, there'd be no reason for any of the other norms of marriage that we're still officially holding on to for now. You know, the presumption of permanence, that it's two people, and so on. So I think that shift is something that preceded the same-sex marriage debates. I think we saw it in lots of different changes in the widespread use of contraception, cohabitation, you name it. We kind of saw sex and marriage mainly as about fulfilling adult desire, and marriage from a public perspective as about putting a stamp of approval on whatever you choose in that realm.
Two final questions for you. Do you think that history will treat Justice Anthony Kennedy as the Harry Blackmun of the infamous Roe v. Wade decision?
Yeah, I think that there's good reason to think that it will. I mean, it's going to take some time, just like it took with Roe v. Wade. At the beginning, it looked like that was going to be accepted by everybody. It's just a matter of time. But when people started thinking harder about the science, about the ethics, about the politics and the religion of the issue, it came out a different way. And I think we're going to have to wait to see, you know, the fallout effects on kids raised by same-sex parents, but also on other aspects of marriage stability in our culture generally. And once we do, we'll see this was an issue that wasn't fully vetted, and the discussion on it was cut short by the court.
If you were given 1 minute face-to-face with Justice Kennedy to make the case for natural marriage, what would you say?
I would say, your vision of what marriage is about, which is conferring dignity on adults, is in a way understandable and even beautiful. I agree with you that everybody has dignity. But if you really think about it, using marriage law to confer dignity is self-defeating. It's going to only reinforce the idea that people who aren't called to marriage just count for less. That's the bad idea you're trying to fight. Join me instead in thinking of marriage as a much more mundane thing. Dignity belongs to everybody, no matter whether they get married or not, or whether they can or want to or not. Marriage is in a way more limited and more simple. It's about what it has done in every other society, which is to give kids the best shot at having this right fulfilled, that they wake up every day with their own mom and dad under the same roof. It does a better job of doing that when it's a man and a woman, and that's what we should at least allow the states to use it for.
Sharif Girgis is a PhD candidate in philosophy at Princeton University and a JD candidate at Yale Law School. He's co-author of the book, What is Marriage? Man and Woman, a Defense. You'll find out more about this book at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Sharif, thank you very much for your time this afternoon.
Thank you.
When we come back, the president of the Lutheran Church Missouri Center will be joining us, Pastor Matt Harrison. He's going to give us his thoughts. I imagine they're probably rather somber thoughts on the Supreme Court's decision to legalize homosexual marriage. We'll be right back. Bethany Lutheran College is pleased to sponsor Issues Etc. and Lutheran Public Radio. Bethany Lutheran College is located in the picturesque river town of Mankato, Minnesota, and is committed to making Christian higher education affordable for all with generous financial aid packages available. At Bethany, you'll find stimulating academic programs, a friendly atmosphere, and opportunities to grow both in intellect and in your faith, all within the framework of a supportive Christian environment. For more information, visit us on the web at blc.edu.
Providing artillery support for the church militant on the front lines, you're listening to Issues Etc.
Thanks to the following congregations for standing with us by joining the Issues Etc. 300. Augsburg Lutheran, Shawnee, Kansas. Peace Lutheran, Fresno, California. Trinity Lutheran, Casper, Wyoming. Memorial Lutheran, Houston, Texas. Trinity Lutheran, Gillette, Wyoming. Our Savior Lutheran, Ridgecrest, California. St. Mary's Lutheran, Des Moines, Iowa. Redeemer Lutheran, Caquabeca Falls, Ontario, Canada. St. Jacoby Lutheran, Shawano, Wisconsin. And St. John's Lutheran, North Prairie, Wisconsin. Find out how your church can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues Etc. in your mission or advertising budget. Go to our website, issuesetc.org, click support, and print a one-page flyer. When your congregation joins the Issues Etc. 300, we'll publicize your congregation on the radio, at our website, and in the Issues Etc. journal. Issuesetc.org, click support, the Issues Etc. 300.